session number 10704, rule 1.
Captain Harris, rule 1. Can you tell me how you came to be in Singapore at the time of its fall in February 1942, please?
In 1938, I joined up in the Territorial Army, and the local regiment that recruited in Bolton was the 5th Battalion, the Loyal Regiment. And we were just a typical territorial battalion. On the outbreak of war, we were almost coincidental with the outbreak, we were turned into a motorcycle battalion and subsequently became the 18th Division Reconnaissance Battalion. The 18th Division was a territorial division, principally based on East Anglia, Cambridgeshire's, Suffolk's, Norfolk's, etc. And there was the Loyals. There were the Loyals, who were mostly, of course, from Lancashire, although there were some intake, that is, men who were drafted to the battalion, probably in 1940, from the Rifle Brigade. So we had a rare mixture of Cockneys and Lancashire lads. The vast majority, of course, of the private soldiers would be either workers from the coal mines, workers in the textile industries, and in the various other industries, like engineering, etc., that would be in and around Bolton. Yes, so the 18th Division was ordered off out of the country in October 1941. We sailed from the Firth of Clyde, and it was just before, of course, the United States came into the war. And halfway across the Atlantic, this great convoy of British ships, which included ships like the Duchess of Bedford, which was the Commodore's ship, the Rena del Pacifico, the Oronce, Sobieski, did I say Rena del Pacifico? Well, all these are famous pre-war passenger liners were turned into troopers. We were met halfway across the Atlantic, well, probably more than halfway across, just south of Iceland, by an American United States fleet. First we knew of it was that planes were flying over us, and we couldn't believe that they could have been the feared Condors, which we were always, we were always thinking about. And then suddenly, we saw the little destroyers, I think there were four stack destroyers, which Roosevelt gave to Churchill on Lend-Lease, turning around, and I happened to be up on the boat deck at a signalling lesson, having a signalling lesson for our signalling officer, Lieutenant Harrison, when these destroyers, suddenly noticed them turning round. And Harrison said, "Now here's your opportunity. What's this message that is coming out from the, the lights that flash, the Morse code or whatever?" Well, we were supposed to be proficient enough to be able to read the dot dot dashes, but none of us really did it. But of course Harrison did, and Harrison read out the message: "Good luck to you. You'll need it. The Yanks are taking over." Now, this was before the United States was in the war, and of course it was a fantastic sight. Not only was there a United States battleship, but there was an aircraft carrier. I remember the name of the aircraft carrier. It was called the Ranger. And probably about 10 other flotilla leaders and destroyers. And they came in and swept in behind us and took us over to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And in Halifax, Nova Scotia, we transshipped from these British transports into United States transports. These were regular U.S. Army transports, like the one that we actually were transferred to, called the, I think it was called the UST, something like that anyway, U.S. troop carriers, which were the normal way in which the United States used to transport their troops about the world in those days. They were run by naval officers and coast guards for the most part. And there were some famous American ships, like the Mount Vernon and the Orizaba, I remember those were two, and of course the West Point, which was in the America, I think she was called, big ship, the biggest ship that the United States merchant marine could boast in those days, long before, of course, the United States was built. But she was a big ship. Anyhow, we all transferred at Halifax. We didn't get any time ashore. Some of us were able, for one reason or another, probably to do with stores, got ashore for about half an hour or so. And we set off and we went down the east coast of America through the passage, I think, between Cuba and Haiti. And finally we landed up at Port of Spain, Trinidad. And I remember I was able to send my wife back a coded message that she shouldn't forget the leaseholds. Tell Herbert, that was the name of my boss, Herbert Lee. Tell Herbert, I'm thinking about him. Love, Bill. And the reason for that was that the firm that I worked for, W.J. Lee, or Marine Paint Manufacturers, used to export paint to Trinidad Leaseholds, which was, of course, an oil company in those days. And that was supposed to let my wife know where we were. We couldn't, of course, obviously, for security reasons, do anything else but code messages. And then we went off right down south, hugging the east, the east coast of Brazil, down and across the South Atlantic. We approached Cape Town from about 500 miles southeast. We arrived in Cape Town, I think it was just after December the 8th, the day of Pearl Harbor, because I remember very well the news that came over, and the Americans were all full of this, and I can remember in the wardroom a Lieutenant Grace of the well-known shipping line saying, "Well, buddy boys, your troubles are over. The United States is in the war alongside Great Britain."
How was that greeted?
Well, we thought it was terrific, of course, but in the next few days, the Americans became very depressed when they heard of what had happened and how it had happened. And we landed at Cape Town, and we had a wonderful time there, like all British troops had. The reception was terrific. Smuts addressed us. He was the Prime Minister? I suppose he would be. And very pro-England. Smuts really that brought South Africa into the war, because they would really have been on the side of the Nazis if the Bruderbund and all these Boers, the opposition, were very pro-Nazi. So we were very lucky, really, that Smuts was there and brought South Africans into the war on our side. And, of course, a lot of South Africans were up at Tobruk at that time. And I think it was just before the terrible news about they were decimated, I think, in North Africa. It was a terrible time for them, I suppose, really. It's all been forgotten, but there we are. And then we set off believing that we were going to the desert, because we'd been kitted out with all the usual, tropical gear, including topis and army drill, which but trousers were most interesting, really, because they could be pulled down in order to. There were long shorts or short longs to start with, but you could unbutton them and pull them down, and they could push them into your stockings. This was to guard against mosquitoes and things like that. But we suddenly found ourselves after getting past, I think it was, would it be Madagascar or somewhere like that, we were sailing towards India. And strangely enough, we were in India for about 3 weeks. What the heck we were doing there, I gosh knows, I don't know. It could hardly have been anything to do with acclimatizing us, because India is very, very different. At that time, very dry, very hot. It was 3 weeks that I suppose you could have said had been wasted, because we then were taken by transports, British transports this time. The Americans left us, and we were taken down the south of India, up through the Banker Straits into Singapore. And the ship that we were on, the Empress of Asia, was an old coal burner on the Pacific run of the Canadian Pacific Steamship Company. And she was set on, bombed as she was going into Singapore, set on fire and abandoned. It was a fantastic show, really, that they got so many men off that ship.
Can you describe the bombing of the ship?
Oh, yes, but I can do better than that. I can describe it, but what I can do is I can give you a wonderful account of it here, which I can certainly substantiate. The ship was about 9 miles off Singapore. We'd been bombed the previous day, near misses, and the reason that I had a grandstand view of the whole thing was that I was in charge of what was known as the emergency squad, and we had 25 men and myself, and we were up there supposed to be putting out any fires or anything like that that might arise as a result of bombs or fire bombs being dropped. And we were lagging behind the rest of the convoy because we'd had some trouble with the crew on board. Yes, I'd like to say this, because they were a lot of bastards. I expect you could understand that they weren't very willing to make any sacrifices and do their jobs, because they were really the sweepings of Liverpool streets, almost impressed men, I guess, because the real stokers on this ship had always previously been Chinese, and they were not very good conditions in the stoke holes. But these fellows refused to work, and they came up, and our men, we formed Major Dutton, who was the company commander of A Company, and was a Bolton textile mill owner. He formed the stokers, rotors, and of course we had lots of very strong men because of the coal miners amongst us, and we stoked this ship into Singapore, got her going again, but she was only doing about 7 knots, and she was really a sitting target, and she was on her own, despite the fact that we had HMS Exeter there and one or two destroyers protecting us. The Japanese dive bombers came in. We thought at first they were our own planes, of course, and then we suddenly saw these bombs being let loose. And they had 3 or 4 direct hits on the Asia. But despite the fire and, so many men crowded in pretty ghastly conditions, because they were all confined to their bunks, if you like, or hammocks or whatever, in the holds of the ship, that there was no panic. That very few, only about 23 men were lost. And most of them were able to either jump into the sea. The lifeboats were no good. She was in a dreadful condition, this ship. I think she might have been unfortunate insofar as the lifeboats may have been damaged by the bombs, but the main damage was right down in the two bombs went right through the center part of the ship, through the big lounge, killing several officers, burning others, landed right down in the, oh, I would think probably about 3 deck, I would think, in the hospital. There were a few casualties there, but the vast majority of the men kept their heads, and it was really remarkable that so many got off the ship. And I was picked up off the ship by an Australian sloop, the HMAS Yarra, Y-A-R-R-A, and taken into Singapore. And I remember standing on Keppel Harbour Quay by the side of the commander, who was a young lieutenant, I don't know what his name was, and he was absolutely amazed that he'd got so many people. He got about 500 or 600 people on this ship, and he said that if he'd taken more than a 5-10 degree turn or something like that, she would have capsized.
So the stokers refused to stoke the ship when the air attacks came?
That's right, yeah.
Was there any...
That was in the Banker Strait on the previous day. They came up and refused to go stay down. And I wouldn't say there were ugly scenes, but I tell you, our men took a bloody dim view of them. But I suppose in a way they, you know, I mean, what have they got to lose? Not much, really. And the idea of being trapped down there in a stoke hole, when bombs are being dropped on you, must be quite a terrifying thing. But nevertheless, they didn't do their job, and... our lads had to go down, and they did it, and they did it very well. Marvellous.
Well, presumably, if you don't stoke the ship doesn't go, and that's
absolutely
a sitting target.
Oh, yes, sitting target. And she was a sitting target. Anyhow, she caught fire, and she was eventually declared a total loss, and she sank off the Sultan Shoal, it is, off Singapore. And we arrived in Singapore, and, of course... we had nothing, except if we stood up in them. I was wearing a pair of shorts, and that was all. I'd lost whatever. I lost my watch, I remember. That must have been blown off during the bombs, and I lost my cigarettes. We had nothing at all, with no weapons, very, very few. A few weapons were dug out of the hole, I remember, and it was very dark. It was quite terrifying. But we were ordered off the ship, and we were very lucky to get away with our lives, really. So we landed in Singapore about, well, that would be about the 8th of February. And by the 15th, of course, Singapore fell. In the meantime, our battalion was, we had no weapons. I remember taking to make contact with the Japanese on the Tuesday. I think it was the 12th. Yes, Tuesday, the 12th of February. I was detailed by my company commander, my best friend Arthur Holt, to lead this section of men into a little part, a little village. It was a little village then, although it had a great big Ford factory there outside Singapore, a place called Bukit Timah, B-U-K-I-T-T-I-M-A, two words. And there I was unfortunate enough to get wounded a couple of times, and I was evacuated. I must say, somewhat light-headedly, because I lost a lot of blood, to Singapore.
How did the wounding come about? Can you describe that?
Well, I had this section of men, and the idea was to make contact with the Japs, to find out where they were. We made contact with them, or put it perhaps if they made contact with us. And I was shot through my right arm, but amazingly the bullet went between the bones. And although I was bleeding profusely, at least I knew... I very quickly got an idea of where exactly the enemy were. Although, I mean, it was all very fluid, and we had no air cover, and they had a plane, one lazily going around, observing overhead. And I thought, well, there's not much more I can do here. I'd better get back. Well, I got back about 500 yards... and I ran into the company commander of B Company, Captain Spencer, and I said, look, Bobby, I said, Because, you see, we all knew each other. We were all married to each other's sisters and so forth and so on. A very close-knit battalion. I said to Bobby, look, I said, I know I'm wounded, but I can take you back to where I was to give you some idea whereabouts they are. And God damn it, we got to the same place again, the same machine gun or sniper pipped me, this time in the left arm, but made a real mess of it. And I'm happy to tell you that ever since then I have received a pension from a grateful government, and it's free of tax, and I don't bear that sniper any ill will at all. So I was taken out, suffering really more than anything else, shock, I suppose, blood. I didn't have any pain. And I got into this hospital and stripped on this bed, and this doctor and a nurse came. I was quite compassmentous, I wasn't out at all. And he said, I'd like your name and number. So I said, Harris, WD, Captain, 72927. Everybody knows their own number, just like that. And he said, you're a POM. That's right. He said, you're a POM, ain't you? So I didn't know what a POM was. And he said, you're English. I said, yes. Oh, we can't have you here. This is an Australian hospital. And I was turfed out. And I finally finished up in the famous or infamous Alexandra Hospital, where the Nips overran the hospital and killed a number of patients. I think the story has been grossly exaggerated, because I was actually there, and I do know that they bayoneted the doctor, the surgeon that's put my arm right, and I know that they did shoot one or two of the orderlies and maybe one or two of the patients. But what they did do, which was horrific really, they took away 100 walking wounded. And I know I was desperate to join the second, two parties of 50. And they rounded up all the officers and men that could walk. And I was 51st on the list. And I remember begging this little Nip to let me go with the others. I had a pair of boots under one arm, which was all bandaged up. The other arm was in plaster. And I just had some pyjamas on. That's all. And I was desperate to get out of this frightful hospital, which had been suffering, you know, from shells from both sides. And it was very terrifying altogether. But I was very, very lucky. About two only of that 100 men got clear and away, because the Japanese executed them all, shot them all in some outbuildings, and two people, one officer and another rank, in some way or another, were able to crawl into the oil that was swimming around the place. They'd bombed the oil tanks, which were quite close to the hospital, you know, the military target, fair enough, and they got into the oil and they disappeared and came back about, I think it must have been about the 17th, a couple of days later. Because all that happened on, I think it was Friday the 14th, 15th, Saturday. And then
You say it was exaggerated what happened at the Alexandra Hospital. Why do you say that?
Well, I don't believe that they were rushing down the wards, bayoneting people and shooting people. It all happened on the ground floor, I think. I certainly didn't see any atrocities being committed. And I don't forget, I was in actually one of the wards. And one of my, subsequently, one of my great friends, who was the quartermaster at the hospital, a chap called Archimedes Lunt, Ted Lunt. He was a secretary of the Bolton of District Far Eastern Prison of War Association. He was the number one WO in the hospital under Colonel Craven, who was a CO. And he told me that there were about four or five hospital staff that were wounded, one or two maybe killed, and probably about half a dozen other ranks. One chap actually was bayoneted on it, Captain Smiley of this surgeon I was talking about. He was actually bayoneted on the operating table in the theatre, because he threw himself over a patient. But all these stories, you know, they do tend to get exaggerated. And you've got to remember that these were the frontline Japanese troops on a high. And my God, I should think any troops could make the mistakes that they did there. I'll forgive them for what they did in the Alexander Hospital, but I didn't know them then, you know.
But you couldn't say that trying to banish a helpless person is a mistake, though.
Well, no, I suppose it's difficult to say that. But, well, you've got to remember that they weren't civilized Westerners like we were. They were victorious troops rushing out of the jungle against a great white power, and they must have been on a tremendous high.
Whereabouts in the hospital were you?
Well, I was probably on the second floor. Maybe the second or third floor. Yes, probably the ground floor, first floor, second floor I was on, I'm pretty sure.
So, were you aware that crimes were being committed by the troops?
Well, we could hear all the bloody noise going on, and we were all getting a bit apprehensive, but I remember the first nip that I saw, he almost looked as surprised and frightened as I did. But I can't say that I saw any bayoneting. I heard a lot of shouting and saw a lot of people running around, but I never saw anybody actually bayoneted. And that's why, if I'm wrong, okay, I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but I always feel that it was greatly exaggerated.
But were people rushing into the ward saying Japanese are killing people?
Yes. Oh, I think we were all very frightened. Because remember, you know, we didn't know what these Japanese... I mean, I think we were, all of us, very apprehensive about the Nips. Even before we'd seen anyone of them, they all looked the same. They all looked absolutely fearful-looking people, you know, when we saw them. Anyway, that's the story of the Alexander Hospital in my book. On the 19th, I marched out with 84 men, walking wounded, to walk the 14 miles from the Alexander Hospital to Singapore. And it was a very emotional trip. I expected that the local inhabitants would be hurling abuse at us, jeering at us, but it wasn't like that at all.
What was their response?
Well,